Well, good morning. It's great to be back here. Thank you. And I couldn't have asked for a better introduction. I actually read that passage from 2 Kings with Elijah and the bears 2 years ago when I was here. And my admonition at that time was, why didn't he just ask the Lord for more hair? That could have solved the problem. And then you...
I'm the only one who just asked for hair.
He wouldn't have had to call any bears down. Well, to my credit, I did suggest other topics that didn't have to do with the Bible directly, and yet I was encouraged. You know, no, we like to have you stir things up talking about the Bible, so here I am. Well, I wanted to talk about the Bible, but in context of morality. And being moral is just not easy. It's tough work. You know, we could just go through life and do our own thing without thinking about it much, but inevitably we're going to run into other people, other living creatures, animals, and we're going to have to make moral decisions. We're going to have to decide what's right and what's wrong. We're going to have to make workable compromises. You know, at school, you had to deal with bullies. Maybe a bully's picking on the new kid, and you have to decide what you're going to do about it. And most of us now are out of school, but we still find a different kind of bully in the workplace. In any kind of relationship you have, in a marriage, you're going to come up against moral quandaries. So there's no getting around the problem of morality unless you plan to move to the far side of the moon or Wyoming. So wouldn't it be great if we had an absolute code of morality, a system that could give us the right answer in every situation all the time? You know, I'm at work and they've told me I've got to work late, but you know, I just got a call and my son needs me to come home and take care of him. Well, wouldn't it be great if I could say, oh, wait a second, I'll check in the book. Hold on, let me look through. Ah, okay, that's what I should do. Or, you know, what if, they're talking about stem cells. Like, oh, man, that's a tough debate. Man, I just haven't studied up much on it. Well, hold on, let me look in the index under S. Oh, that's the answer. Okay, phew, that's all solved. Or, you know, what if, I've got a gambling addiction. What do I do about it? Flip. It would be great if it were that easy, but that hasn't stopped people from trying to write systems of absolute morals, codes, that we can use to guide our life decisions. So we're going to talk about those, but in particular, the Bible, both for the in the interest of being brief, you know, because I've only got so much time, and also in the interest of sticking to things I know. There have been many attempts to write moral codes in the course of history. Some of you may have heard of the Code of Hammurabi from the 18th century before the Common Era, a very old document. Even older than that is the Code of Ur-Nammu from the 21st century before the Common Era, just as far back in the past from the year one as we are in the future. Of course, the Bible in its various incarnations, both the Old Testament and the later edition of the New, the Quran, the Hindu Vedas, the Book of Mormon, Dianetics. All of these are books that have been written, scriptures that tell us how we're supposed to live our lives. I'll read a quote from the philosopher John Locke. He said, "The Bible is one of the greatest blessings bestowed by God on the children of men. It has God for its author, salvation for its end, and truth without any mixture for its matter. It is all pure, all sincere, nothing too much, nothing wanting." Boy, that's a pretty bold claim and a pretty strong endorsement. And after hearing a couple of the things that Howard read and a few things that I'm going to read, it makes you question that a little bit. Really, can we just uncritically take what the Bible presents? So let's start with that most kind of fundamentalist, literalist approach. What are the problems with that? Well, there's the obvious problem is that not everybody has access to these books. There are people in many parts of the world that don't read or they've never heard about this. And you could say, well, you know, it's not for want of trying. The church is sending out missionaries all the time, translating books. But there are still many people who have lived and died without ever experiencing one of these moral codes. Also is the problem of if you're going to have an absolute moral code that's always right in all circumstances and was handed down by the creator of the universe, then, well, which moral code do you choose? There's a lot of them vying for competition, and they all say, we have the answer. And we also find that as we examine the scriptures themselves, we find them to be very much the products of human culture. They're constrained to the time they were written and the people who wrote them. The Bible itself I brought a miniature copy, is not just one book. It's 66 different books, at least in the Protestant church. And there are many different authors, over 40, we think. They have different agendas, different things that they're writing about, different times. It was written over geographically and chronologically, a large span of history and space. There are a lot of different morals that are in here. In the Torah alone, there are 613 precepts that one is to follow. That's the first five books of the Bible. You read from one of them, Leviticus. 248 of them are positive commandments, you know, do this. And 365 are negative commands, don't do this. One for every day of the year. And so how does one parse those? Does one just say, oh, every single one of them is something that I should incorporate into my daily life? One of the problems is that some of them are just out of date. From Leviticus 19:19, just two chapters before where you read from, it says, do not wear clothing woven of two kinds of material. All right, well, there goes polyester, and I'm sure all of us have some sort of cotton blends on. And really, when you think about it, what's wrong with that? You know, that maybe that made sense for some reason at some time, but it doesn't now. In the same chapter, it says, do not cut the hair at the sides of your head or clip off the edges of your beard. In which case, I'm in trouble because I shaved a couple days ago. Obviously, this isn't something that we should take to heart. A little more incendiary from the New Testament, Paul writes to the Corinthians in chapter 14, as in all the congregations of the saints, women should remain silent in the churches. They are not allowed to speak, but must be in submission, as the law says. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home, for it is disgraceful for a woman to speak in church. Ew. Really? Okay, we got a thumbs up back there. But, but when you bring this up, many fair-minded Christians will say, well, you know, that was, you know, appropriate at the time, or there was some kind of dispute at the church, certainly, that they were trying to resolve, and he just wanted things to be peaceful, or, you know, oh, within the culture, that made sense. Whatever the explanation is, if there is one, it's not relevant anymore. Similarly, in chapter 11, Paul writes again, every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, and every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is just as though her head were shaved. If a woman does not cover her head, she should have her hair cut off. So these are not things that we espouse, you know, and we can immediately identify that these are not moral precepts. We'll talk a little bit more about that. So those are outdated morals. There's also modern issues that are too current for the text. The text just doesn't decide on. I mentioned stem cells earlier. They didn't know about them. It's just not in there. It wasn't a debate at the time. And maybe you can extrapolate lessons from what's in there, but there's no direct addressing of those issues. You know, if you wonder, can I download a movie, you know, for free off the internet if I already bought it on VHS? You know, that's a moral quandary of sort. But again, this is not the place to look it up. We have far more serious issues like homosexuality. Jesus just never talked about it. And we've all heard some of the very negative treatments that the Bible has towards that particular subject. So there are issues that are too old. There are issues that are too current for the scope of the Bible. But there are also the passages that just shouldn't be followed no matter what time you're in. I want to talk a bit about slavery, and the Bible talks about slavery explicitly. In Exodus 21, it says, if a man beats his male or female slave with a rod, and the slave dies as a direct result, he must be punished. But he is not to be punished if the slave gets up after a day or two, since the slave is his property. In Ephesians, from the New Testament, chapter 6, it says, slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear, and with sincerity of heart, just as you obey Christ. And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there's no favoritism with him. So at least it's admonishing the slave masters to be a little nicer, but still, it's not condemning the whole practice, as it should. And when people point out that Jesus never spoke on slavery, I've asked this directly to pastors and friends. They've said, well, you know, that it was so entrenched at the time, he couldn't be a revolutionary. And I said, really? Well, wasn't he revolutionary in other respects? Why not be revolutionary on that one very, very important issue? And this gets to another point of using the Bible as your moral code, is that you can argue any side of any debate with it. Whatever side you come from. I had a kind of a disagreement with a Presbyterian minister over this. I had pointed out that the arguments for slavery came almost exclusively from the Bible. There were some economic arguments. And he said, oh, no, the abolition of slavery, that was the Christian movement. And so I sent him a few quotes, and I'll read some of them for you. These are, from the time of the 1850s and 60s when this was being debated. Slavery was established by decree of Almighty God. It is sanctioned in the Bible, in both Testaments, from Genesis to Revelation. It has existed in all ages, has been found among the people of the highest civilization, and in nations of the highest proficiency in the arts. That was Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederate States of America. Reverend Alexander Campbell said, "There is not one verse in the Bible inhibiting slavery, but many regulating it. It is not, then, we conclude, immoral." So there we very clearly have someone drawing from what is in the Bible to what is moral. The right of holding slaves is clearly established in the Holy Scriptures, both by precept and example. A reverend, R. Furman, a Baptist of South Carolina. It's just shocking stuff. But these were the arguments being made. And if your understanding of morality is that simple, that, oh, well, the morals in here are correct, then you don't critically approach it. You don't think about it on your own. Also, we find some that are inconsistent. All of you, I would assume, have gotten your census forms. You have to figure out, am I going to fill out the census and mail it back? It says it's applied by law. I see someone shaking their head. No. Okay. Well, we see that in 2 Samuel 24, it says, "Again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, 'Go and take a census of Israel and Judah.' So the king said to Joab and the army commanders with him, 'Go throughout the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and enroll the fighting men,'" and so on. And then in 1 Chronicles 21, it tells the exact same story, except remember, first the Lord commanded David to do this. But in this retelling, almost exactly the same except for this point, it says, "Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel." And then it tells the exact same story, almost word for word. What are we to make of that? Well, it just disagrees with itself. Either censuses are from the devil or they're from God. Do I fill out my census? I don't know. Very current issue. Some of the morals that we get from the Bible are just plain obvious. Thou shalt not kill. Really? Yeah, we know that. And yet we find that many people who promote war and various forms of killing do so, in the name of God and use the Bible to justify it. Thou shalt not steal. Yeah, that one's pretty obvious. I mean, it's good. I agree with it. But really, do we need that from some sort of transcendent source? And I want to be fair. There are some very good insights. Again, this is a human document, and it encompasses the range of human experience. I read this one once before when I was here. Ephesians 4 says, "In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry." I think that's a really good precept. If you're sitting there kind of stewing over or something, it might be good to go to the person that you feel you've offended or hurt and try to clear things up. I think that's nice. Another example from Matthew 7:12. We've all heard this. Jesus was saying, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets." This is the golden rule. And we'll talk a little more about it, but I think it's generally a very good principle. It's a step up from what's called lex talionis, the law of retribution that we see in Exodus 21. "But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." They wanted to make sure no stone was left unturned there. That whatever's done to you, you just do it right back, and that's what's fair. And that's in the Bible. That's also in the Hammurabi Code that I mentioned earlier that far predates the Bible. But we would agree that the golden rule is a step upward and something that we should pay attention to. As Gandhi said, "An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind." But we have a problem here. If we have a bunch of things that we agree with and that we say are good and a bunch of things that are bad and we agree are bad, then we have to cherry pick. We're forced to. And many Christians do this. Oh, actually, all of them do that, and we do it too. And it's a good thing. I'm glad that they cherry pick the good things. And they don't preach sermons on, Samuel calling out the bears or the seven times retribution that was mentioned in the passage you read from Leviticus. That's even worse than eye for an eye. That's seven eyes for one eye. And we've seen the cherry picking in various forms. I was very delighted to borrow from your lending library one of the times previous that I came here, the Jefferson Bible. And it was a book in which Thomas Jefferson had taken the moral precepts that he liked of Jesus, took out all the claims of divinity, which is pretty much the whole book of John, and just left some of the nice stories, none of the miracles, but left a lot of the parables. And so we have to ask, if we're able to do that kind of cherry picking and pick out the things that we find to be good, what is our criteria for doing that? Clearly, it's something outside of the book itself. The book can't contain that. It has to be somewhere, perhaps, in our minds. Now, many Christians would agree readily with pretty much everything I've said. They would agree the Bible isn't enough by itself in isolation. They will agree that its messages can be contradictory or vague or indirect for modern situations. But they would say that it's a useful rubric if combined with personal guidance by God, if God is speaking to you and helping you interpret it. His input will show you how to interpret it and read the entire text to show a broad global message, the one that we are to heed. Reading it and studying it in community will correct for the errors that an individual might make. This is a more sophisticated argument. This is saying, well, we can all agree on certain things that are incorrect and God will give us guidance. Well, there are problems with that approach as well. And I think the first problem is brilliantly illustrated in a joke by the comedian Emo Phillips. It was called The Funniest Religious Joke of All Time. So let's hope I can do it justice. Once I saw this guy sitting on a bridge about to jump. I said, "Don't do it." He said, "Nobody loves me." I said, "God loves you. Do you believe in God?" "Yes," he said. I said, "Are you a Christian or a Jew?" He said, "A Christian." I said, "Me too. Protestant or Catholic?" He said, "Protestant." I said, "Me too. What franchise?" He said, "Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist?" He said, "Northern Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Conservative Baptist or Northern Liberal Baptist?" He said, "Northern Conservative Baptist." I said, "Me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region or Northern Conservative Baptist Eastern region?" And he said, "Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes region." I said, "Me too. Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1871 or Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912? He said, "Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region of 1912. I said, "Die, you heretic!" And I pushed him off the bridge. The reason we have so many branchings of religious sects to the point where they resemble the biological tree of life is that there's no way to verify each person's personal experience of how God is telling him to interpret these morals. We get inconsistent messages on any given issue from person to person, place to place, time to time. A Methodist from the 19th century will disagree with a Methodist from the 21st century on a lot of issues. An Anglican in England will disagree with an Anglican in the United States. A Lutheran will disagree with a Baptist. A Baptist will disagree with an Anabaptist. And an Anabaptist will disagree with another Anabaptist sitting just down the pew from him. So this becomes anything but predictable and consistent when everybody has their own interpretations. And so in practice, it ends up being the opposite of absolute morality. It's completely relative. You know, everybody just kind of interprets it in their own way and claims an absolute source that you just can't question. You know, there's just no way to have a conversation about that. So, funny enough, God usually agrees with the person who's speaking for him. Go figure. We should also be wary of that because, admittedly, you people will say that the connection to God is not always strong. You know, that they're not always feeling God. So how can we expect on a day-to-day basis when we're facing these issues for that inspiration to come immediately on demand whenever we need it? And like I said, there's no way to verify that which person is genuinely getting the correct message from God. So yet again, we are left asking, what is the criteria by which we make these choices? So what is the alternative to an absolute morality? Well, the proponents of the scriptural interpretation, of the scriptural morality, would say that the alternative is relative morality. Whatever is good for you is good for you. Whatever is good for me is good for me. And that sounds all fine and dandy until it comes to a really important issue like killing. You know, I can't just decide that, oh, it's not good for, you know, I think killing is okay, so I'm going to go off on a spree or something. No, that just doesn't work. And so I think that's a caricatured position, and I won't spend too much time trying to defend it. But I think that kind of relative approach only works in areas of personal choice. I'll tell you a little story. I don't own anything corduroy. I just don't wear it. I avoid it. And when I was young, and really this is why, when I was young I had these corduroy pants. I think they were just too tight and uncomfortable. And I remember just hating those things. But, you know, my mom would still dress me at that point. And I remember one day I had an ink pen in my pocket and it spilled and it just, you know, coated the thing with this black blue ink. And so finally we got to get rid of these things. And I remember telling my sister, I will never wear corduroy again. And she said, all right, if it became popular again, you'd totally wear it, you'd give in. I said, no, I will never wear corduroy again. And this became really important to me. It was my word. I guaranteed that I would not do this. And I haven't worn corduroy since. And now there's really no good reason for it. I don't have anything against it. But I remember I told my sister just a couple of years ago, you know, I've never worn corduroy. And she's like, that's nice. I said, remember, I told you I would never do that. I said, oh, no, no, I don't remember that at all. So here I was trying to prove something for no good reason. But that's an issue of personal preference. And yeah, no one's getting harmed when I wear corduroy, and I'm not infringing on anyone's rights by wearing corduroy, and vice versa. It's okay there for people to make cultural decisions, you know, based on personal preference, but it doesn't work for morality. So again, what are some other options? Well, law is another option, and we've had laws for just as long as we've had other forms of coded morality. It's a secular approach, something that people of all religious varieties and no religious beliefs can agree on, and we can work on creating consistent laws. And there's some advantages to laws because they can be agreed upon by a majority or an elected set of representatives, and we can find general rules for good, upstanding behavior. Those ideas are enforced but are also not set in stone. If we decide that they're no longer relevant, we can change them. We can evolve them. But also, law is slow to respond to new situations, and we don't want it to replace the personal choice in our lives. And we only want it to cover certain issues. We want the law to help keep us safe from both, you know, injury and from bad business practices, but we don't want it to tell us what to do in the bedroom, or at least I don't. And we don't want it, you know, controlling every minute aspect of our lives, you know, like trying to decide whether to stay at work or go home. You know, that's not its role. And again, we have to say, where do those precepts in the law come from? Again, it comes from a different source, and again, I'm pointing back to the brain. You know, we are individually able to make these decisions. So what am I proposing as the alternative to this absolute moral system, to a relative moral system, or to just, you know, blind adherence to law? And what I'm advocating is just doing what comes naturally to us, being moral and thinking morally. In fact, I think, you know, your affirmation statement, I'm always leery of, you know, reading with everybody else anything that's written down on a piece of paper. So I was reading closely as we all read the affirmation together, but I totally agreed with it. You know, we covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth. You know, that's great. And I think what it comes down to is moral logic, the calculations of happiness and suffering. And we can ask those questions. We can say, this action that I want to do or not do, is that going to cause suffering? And then is it going to promote happiness? And it's not always going to be easy. You know, there's going to be pros and cons. You know, your happiness may bring about someone else's suffering, so you have to cede to their needs, to not causing them suffering. The point I want to make is that any moral worth its salt can be backed up with moral logic. So if someone comes to you and they say, Gesundheit, if they say, well, let's see, what would be an example? Premarital sex is bad. You could say, okay, well, why? They would say, well, the Bible says you shouldn't do that. Okay, but why? Oh, well, maybe someone isn't, you know, ready for a relationship early on. Maybe they'll get pregnant and they're not ready to have a child or something. Okay, well, those are real reasons. We can talk about that. You know, if someone says abortion is wrong, you say, okay, why? They say, well, the Bible says so. You say, okay, but really, why? And they would say, well, you know, there's a human life, and, you know, you can talk about real reasons, you know, without making any kind of claim to a god or to a book. And if someone says, you know, homosexuality is wrong, you could say, okay, why? They would say, well, the Bible says so. And then you'd say, okay, but really why? They'd say nothing. Because what kind of suffering could they talk about? They could only talk about happiness. So when you force someone to speak in a rational language about reasons for why something is good or bad, why it is moral or immoral, then you get to the real crux of the matter. You can actually discuss and exchange real ideas without making any claims to having special revelation. To borrow an argument from the author Sam Harris, if the Pope woke up tomorrow and decided all of a sudden that contraceptives in Africa were a good idea, it wouldn't be because he stayed up late the night previous and discovered a passage in the Bible he'd never read before. Oh, whoops, we've been misinterpreting this all along. You know, we should be saving these nearly 4 million lives a year that are being lost to AIDS. And it wouldn't be because God had all of a sudden decided that it was immoral before and now it's moral. It would be because he'd finally heard the cries of all those people suffering, that he had listened to that and decided to change his mind. So what I advocate is looking at the world that way, and it's never going to be easy. There's not going to be any quick or fast answers, but we have the capability to evaluate the situations in our lives in those terms of happiness and suffering. I'll return to the golden rule. I think it's a good precept, and what it does is it asks us to do that. Jesus states it otherwise in Luke 6:31. Do to others as you would like them to do to you. This is a positive kind of happiness-centered moral logic. It's saying, you know, whatever causes you happiness, try to do that for others as well. The silver rule is a kind of an approximation, but from the other side. And Confucius said this in the 6th century before the Common Era. He said, never impose on others what you would not choose for yourself. So again, that's looking at more the suffering side of things and saying, if something would cause you suffering, don't impinge that upon others. It was also stated in the Mahabharata from the Vedic tradition of India many centuries before the Bible or Confucius had anything to say about it. It said, this is the sum of duty. Do not unto others that which would cause you pain if done to you. These are generally good rules, and I think that we can apply them in our own lives for moral guidance. So you shouldn't have to believe anything without evidence in order to be moral. And that's the main point I want to make. We can honestly and consistently pick and choose if we agree that these scriptures are man-made and are every bit as wise and also every bit as fallible as we are. We shouldn't focus just on one book alone. There's a lot of human tradition that we can pick through, and we can find the good things that they had to say, and we can ignore the bad things that they had to say, and we can add to it. And the bottom line that I want to leave today is that we can never expect morality to be simple. And I think expecting your answers to come, you know, pre-made for you is just too easy. It takes work and it takes thought. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.